Have the marshal call court to session.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Reyes, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have arguments by Zoom today. Today is November 30, 2022. Six cases on the calendar today. Our first one is A220368, State of Minnesota versus Anderson, or Anderson versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, just a few notes. We're on Zoom today. These matters are being recorded. Please state your name and your client's name before you begin speaking. Let us know how you'd like us to reference you, if anything. These matters are being recorded. As I said, no other recordings are permitted. And with that, counsel, you may you'll each have 15 minutes. You should see the clock up here on the screen. And the appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning, Judge Frisch, Judge Reyes, Judge Kirk. Your honors, may it please the court. My name is Greg Scanlon, S-C-A-N-L-A-N, and I represent the appellant, Leah Anderson. We are asking the court to reverse count one outright because what happened in this case is not the crime defined by the charged subdivision. We are also asking the court to grant a new trial based on the prosecutor's exhibit, which misrepresented to the jury that Ms. Anderson had confessed. I do want to make sure we have time to discuss the engage in storing element of the charged crime in particular, as well as the prejudice prong of the plain error admission of the confession. I do have prepared remarks. However, I'm also happy to simply proceed to the court's questions and comments, if that's how you would prefer to proceed. Hearing none. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Scanlon. So I would like to start with the statute itself, where it talks about, they said no person may knowingly engage in storing methamphetamine paraphernalia, quote, where a child might reasonably be expected to be present. Isn't that the case here? The mother knew that he might be reasonably present because that was the date and time of his scheduled visit, right?
That's correct. I mean, my argument with respect to that element is simply that it rests on two things. It rests on the state, my argument that the state has to prove that she knows, continues to know, as long as that his appearance is planned, anticipated, she has to continue to know that it's happening. And my argument is simply that she can't know or be aware of anything when she's asleep. It's a unique situation. She fell asleep, and that's why I'm saying, as to that element, she's not responsible for what happened while she was asleep. Even if before she fell asleep, she was on the hook for anticipating his presence.
But counsel, he has a bedroom at that residence, and she was asleep in his bed. So why is it unreasonable for the jury to infer that a child might reasonably be expected to be present in a space where that same child has a bedroom and a bed?
He had a bedroom from when he lived there previously. He had not lived there in a while, and there was a court order currently that custody was with the grandmother. And so,
but he still had a bedroom there.
He did. Yeah, I mean, I guess my sufficiency argument, I think the stronger of the two arguments it has to do with engage in storing. And it rests on the fact that this really is a subdivision 2B case. Subdivision 2B makes it the same felony crime, to knowingly cause or permit a child to be exposed to a meth pipe, essentially, to be exposed to paraphernalia. And exposed under Freeze means to be subjected to a risk of harm based on the meth pipe. When you have a meth pipe, you're using meth, and you leave a meth pipe laying about where a child is going to show up, that's causing him to be exposed to that pipe, to be put at risk of harm with respect to that pipe, especially where the pipe has methamphetamine in it. It's a subdivision 2 crime. Instead, she's being charged with engaging in storing the pipe. In other words, what she did by allegedly by leaving or by leaving the pipe on the floor, that has to be storing, to engage in storing under the statute. That's the legislature's language.
Why can't the jury? I mean, we can slice it in a number of different ways, given the facts of this case. We could, or the jury could infer that she was storing the pipe in the case, or she was storing the pipe in the case in the living room, or she was storing the pipe in the case in the living room in the trailer. So there's a lot of layers here. And as distinguished from that storing, she didn't discard it. She didn't throw it away. She didn't put it in a place where she was no longer using it or having use for it. So why is it unfair, especially given our case law, for the jury to make that inference, given that evidence that was admitted at trial?
Well, if it were in the case, I would feel differently. If it were on a shelf, if it were in a drawer, if it were somewhere, storing has to mean something. It has to mean something besides possession. Leaving it on the floor, yes, that's constructive possession. That's what the state argued. Constructive possession is the same thing as storing. It can't be that. It has to mean.
Why does storage have to be in a particular place? What about the definition requires that storing an item has to be in a place? Why can't it be stored out in the open?
It could be. I suppose some things are. But again, we have to give some kind of definition to the word storing. And to me, what storing is, it's keeping safe for future use. It's putting it away or putting it somewhere for future use. If it's at hand for current use, if it's immediately available for my current use, it's not stored.
Why are those mutually exclusive? I'm not tracking with that, because it seems to me that you seem to argue that there's two different ways that it could be stored, but I don't know why it's mutually exclusive, because the language talks about storing any methamphetamine paraphernalia. There's not any limiting language as to how it's stored. So, for example, Judge Frisch's example of, can't you store it in a room? Why is that not storage? Why does storage have to be so specific and narrow? It seems like you're trying to read in narrowing language to the statute, and it doesn't have any narrow language.
Well, here's why. It's because it's already a crime to possess paraphernalia. It's a crime, in fact, to deliver paraphernalia to a minor. That's 152.094. And so it has to be something more than just, oh, it's in your house, or it's around here somewhere, I don't know where it is, or yeah, I just left it on the nightstand where, you know, when I was done with it. And again, I'm not saying it has to be a particular place, but there has to be the intent of putting it somewhere so you can come back in the future and get it. I don't think it's also problematic because of the way the case was argued in this particular trial. I mean, the state said it's the same thing as possession, and the court cannot allow that approach to this charging subdivision stand. It can't be the same as possession because we already have a crime for possessing paraphernalia.
Mr. Scanlon, can I turn you to the second argument that's in your brief? And that is the issue with respect to the exhibit that contained some information that you're objecting to now. Can you help us understand how the admission of that, of the remaining pages, I think it's Exhibit 5, right? Exhibit 5?
Yes.
How those remaining pages affected the fairness and integrity of the proceedings. I speaking for myself and not my colleagues, I understand your argument that the admission of the additional pages was plainly erroneous. I could probably get over the hump of it affecting his substantial rights, but I'm wondering how it affected the fairness and integrity of the proceedings when the jury was only out for a very short period of time. No one referenced this material. And in your brief, you seem to concede that everyone was unaware of the inadmissible nature of this evidence.
So I'll address the three things specifically. I think if you look at Hansen, in Hansen, this court's an unpublished decision. It's cited in my brief. And that's a case where the prosecutor stood up and argued in opening and in closing that the client had confessed to possessing a firearm on a particular date. The evidence absolutely did not support that. And so that was error. That was prosecutorial misconduct. And they found plain error. They found that it affected defendants' rights. And they said, this affects the integrity of these proceedings because they stood up and told the jury something that was not true and was not supported by the evidence. In this case, it's not just the prosecutor saying something, and because what the lawyers say isn't evidence. This is something that went to the jury room as evidence. And so that's the first part. I think it does affect the integrity of judicial proceedings. And as far as nobody noticing, I mean, which way does that cut? I mean, the fact that an exhibit of this nature, saying that she confessed to the crime that we're arguing about, it says something that isn't true that solves the case for everybody. Nobody even noticed it. The judge didn't look at it, didn't see it. The prosecutor didn't look at it, didn't see it. Defense attorney didn't look at it, didn't see it. That goes to the heart of integrity. I mean, who's minding the store?
But how do we know that they didn't look at it and see it? And in particular, I'm focusing on defense counsel. That seems speculative to say that defense counsel didn't look at it and didn't see it. I mean, couldn't that have just been part of this trial strategy? And I'm thinking about the overall trial strategy of agreeing to not have the person testify at trial and let in the form, the documentation, rather than having the testimony because of appellant's desire to want to go forward with a trial.
Well, and we only get to that if you decide that this wasn't prosecutorial misconduct or that it wasn't plain error admission affecting substantial rights. But I just don't think there's any way that a defense attorney looking at an exhibit that told the jury incorrectly, falsely, absolutely false, that his client had confessed to the only issue raised in the case and wouldn't at least address it in closing. Oh, by the way, you're going to see this exhibit that says XYZ. That's not true. Would have said something about it. You can't let a confession go to the jury and say nothing, do nothing. That's absolutely ineffective assistance of counsel.
Can you just help me with the record, Mr. Scanlon? It was unclear to me how long the jury was out. It looked to me that it went out at about 2:00 and then it came back before 5:00, but I wasn't sure how long the jury was out. If you know, if you don't know, that's fine.
I do. It's actually in my brief. I sort of described it in the brief in terms of how long they were out in relation to how long it took the testimony to be presented. I can look for that right now. If I can't put my hands on it right away, I can certainly find it in the interim.
You don't need to wait. You don't need to spend your precious time looking for it now. Thank you.
Yeah.
I did have a follow-up question on the form that had been submitted. Isn't that really duplicative of the child's testimony that the pipe had in fact been in her home? I mean, isn't that really the crux of the issue?
Well, okay, but if that his testimony and their bias against her was strongly contested, this is what the two parties argued. Oh, he saw it there. And then defense saying, well, he's making this up because he doesn't want to live with her and he doesn't want to spend time with her and grandma hates her too and all that. And so a confession telling the jury, oh, don't worry about any of that. She confessed to police that she had it in the house. Again, this was the only issue argued. and was only argued as, did she possess it or not? Which is problematic under the elements, but it's also problematic for this reason, because she was told in the jury room, without anybody knowing, she was told in the jury room that, oh, they were told in the jury room, oh, she confessed to it. She confessed to possessing it, having it in her house. And that tips the scale.
How do you know they were told that?
It says that in the exhibit.
Okay, but that doesn't mean they read that.
Well, we certainly can't presume that they didn't read an exhibit that was given to them.
Apparently, the attorneys didn't.
Well, but jurors are instructed. They were instructed by the court. You have to look at everything before you decide this case. And this was the only thing that had any text on it. There were four pictures and then this four-page exhibit. It was the only thing they had in there to read.
But it was offered only to prove that it was meth.
Well, I mean, to the extent that it's prosecutorial misconduct, then I'll let the state argue that there's no reasonable likelihood that anybody in the jury room read that exhibit and saw that part. I mean, if that's it, you know, that doesn't seem reasonable to me. Reasonable to say that it's impossible that anybody saw it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Scanlon. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir. Mr. Bueller.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Bueller. I'm the first assistant Polk County attorney, and I'm appearing from Crookston this morning. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this appeal. And Judge Frisch, just to start off, in looking at my boss's notes from the file, it looks like the jury went out at 1:55 p.m. and was back in at 3:42 p.m. So I would like to begin my argument with this argument that counsel continues to make, that this involves prosecutorial misconduct. The reason I say that is I've been doing this job for more than 30 years now, and it seems to me that this term misconduct gets thrown about way too much. And in this case, we're not only accusing the prosecutor of misconduct, we're also accusing Mr. Goodmanson, who is a longtime public defender in Northwest Minnesota. In fact, he's the most experienced public defender, and he supervises, I believe, the public defenders in eight counties up here, of a total dereliction of duty, according to counsel. And the only reason that this is deemed to be misconduct is because counsel has set up a false narrative in this case. And I say that, if you look at counsel's brief, nowhere does he acknowledge the fact that prior to exhibit number 5 being offered, the prosecutor actually identified the three documents that were in that exhibit. The BCA report of the examination of physical evidence, the BCA request for analysis, and the two pages 2 and 3 being the evidence submission form. That was identified in the record, in front of the jury, in front of the judge, in front of counsel, and he gave the exhibit to counsel with a chance for him to review it prior to being offered, and counsel said no objection. How is this misleading, concealing, or attempting to deceive anyone when you're openly and identifying for the record exactly what the exhibit is before it's being introduced? And the reason I say this is a false narrative is if you look at counsel's brief, at page 8, he makes a false statement when he claims that the first time that police reports, recorded statements, and other discovery were provided to the defense would have been on July 20th of 21, when he refers to index number 59. That's absolutely incorrect. The original discovery was provided to first counsel on September 15th of 2020. That's exhibit number 21. It was then again provided to Mr. Goodmanson again on February 10th of 2021. That was exhibit number 46.
Mr. Bueller, in fairness, I think the argument essentially is that when she agreed to not postpone the trial so that the BCA scientist could be present at trial, she did so because she said that she wasn't objecting to the lab reports. And the lab report is only the first page of Exhibit 5, and the remaining pages of Exhibit 5 is something else. So regardless of how he's characterizing it now, her waiver of her confrontation rights relates to only the lab results. So, moving past that, the thing that was admitted, you will agree, her confession, was improper.
And I readily concede that, Your Honor, the statement it is, and it's just so we're clear, it's admitted to having the pipe in her house. That's the statement that there is no factual support in the record for.
So let's talk about whether the admission of that statement affects the fairness and integrity of the proceedings. Do you want to address that, counsel?
Well, the way I look at this, Your Honor, is, and I've cited a whole slew of cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court in which they've addressed this issue in a multiple varying contexts with regard to the failure to properly redact either a document or a recorded statement, particularly by a defendant. And the courts over and over again, first of all, have never said that is misconduct. So that's the first point I'm trying to make here, is that labeling this as misconduct is, I don't think, accurate. This is a ordinary trial error that occurred. It's unfortunate, but trial errors occur in virtually every trial. I don't know that I've ever had a completely error-free trial in 30 years, but that's what the plain error standard is meant to address. You've got a whole series of cases. You know, you've got the cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court in Mosley, Pearson, and Hall. You've got published opinions from this court in Robinette, Noor, Waymus, Hoppe, and several unpublished opinions I cited. They talk about it depends upon the nature of the evidence. And I am not aware of any case, and counsel is certainly not cited to any case, that says it affects a defendant's substantial rights or it affects the fairness, reputation of the integrity of judicial proceedings for an exhibit to go to the jury that is never mentioned by anyone at any time during the course of the trial. The prosecutor never referred to this statement contained on page 2 of exhibit number 5 during his opening statement, during his closing argument. Mr. Goodmanson never referred to it in his opening statement, during his closing argument. No witness during the course of the trial ever referred to the statement in any way, shape, or form. So you have a small statement containing an exhibit that was never highlighted by anyone. So when you look at the factors that you're to determine, the strength of the case, the pervasiveness of the error, whether the evidence was highly persuasive, the manner it was presented, was it used in closing argument, was there an opportunity to respond or counter? You know, in this case, when there's no reference whatsoever to that statement, I don't know how you can conclude that the defendant's substantial rights were affected or that this seriously affects the fairness, integrity, of public reputation, judicial proceedings. Now, the unpublished opinion that counsel relies upon, Hansen, by his own admission, is a case in which the prosecutor stood up and argued in his opening and closing the improper evidence. It's before the jury. It's been highlighted by the prosecution. That's a far cry from evidence that goes to the jury that they're not made aware of at all. And that's what several of this court's opinions are, particularly in Noor, Waymus, Hoppe, Yang, and Larson, were all documents that end up going to the jury that contain clearly inadmissible evidence, including evidence that had been stipulated to, such as prior convictions, whether the defendant was a predatory offender, things along those lines. And in each one of those cases, this court did not find that it was plain error. The reason being that if there's nothing in the record to indicate that the jury was actually had this evidence brought to its attention or was argued in some fashion, there's no basis for inferring that the jury would have considered this improper evidence. And as I acknowledge in my brief, this would be a whole different case had the prosecutor stood up and argued in his closing argument or some witness at trial testified to this statement. But that is not the case that we have here. Instead, you have just speculation that the jury must have considered this and it must have affected the verdict. And I also want to point out one thing about the plain error standard review. Remember, the plain error standard review is essentially judging the trial judge in this case. And counsel makes that clear at page 2 of his brief when he says it's an error by the trial court in allowing this evidence to go to the jury. So how was Judge Harbutt to determine that this was an error based upon an exhibit that had been identified in the record, provided to counsel? Counsel reviewed it, said he had no objection to it. I mean, implicit in counsel's argument is that in every trial, a district court judge would have to stop the trial, read line by line every single exhibit, then come back into court and raise sua sponte any potential objections that he might see to it and get arguments from the parties who rule on it. Again, I've been trying cases 30 years. I've never had a judge do that. But that's what's different about this case, in that plain has two different meanings in this case. You know, the error is plain in the to the extent that this statement was a hearsay statement not supported by the declarant at trial. But it's not plain or obvious, which is one of the definitions of plain, that anybody knew of this. And it certainly wasn't obvious to the district court. This isn't like an argument that was brought or was made in court that was clearly obvious that the district court didn't intervene on or witness testimony. This is an exhibit that contained a small statement that the district court was never brought to its attention in any way, shape, or form. So it's really hard to find fault with the district court for not sua sponte, taking the time, breaking from the trial, and reviewing line by line every portion of this exhibit before ruling on it, when in fact there's no objection from appellant's counsel at trial. And this wasn't like this was a last minute disclosure. This had clearly been disclosed to counsel previously during the course of these proceedings. We had the issue about the test results even before trial. Both appellant and her counsel both stipulated them coming in. And we also have to look at the fact that when Deputy Walker testified, Mr. Goodman actually cross-examined him with regard to exhibit number 5 in the chain of custody. And before the exhibits were provided to the jury, again, Mr. Goodmanson was provided with an opportunity to review those exhibits and said he didn't need to do so. So what is Judge Harbert supposed to do on that record? How do you find plain error with regard to his conduct when, in fact, he was never alerted in any way, shape, or form that there was an error in this case? And I would note that even the appellant herself, when she fired Mr. Goodmanson on the day of sentencing and said that she wanted a new trial, never claimed that it was any part of admission of exhibit number 5 that was a basis for a new trial. So she herself didn't even deem this to be an issue that was worthy of a new trial. It's only appellant's new counsel that's raising that argument.
Counsel, though, just, from having been a trial court judge for a long, long time, when these exhibits, and, seriously, I think in hundreds of cases, I had one or two where they actually wanted the analyst to show up. It's almost always agreed that the report's going to come in, unless they're actually disputing whether the substance is what it says it is or the weight or whatever. But in my experience, all that ever came in was that first page, the report itself, the analysis itself. Why was this whole thing introduced,
Well, I just would tell you, Your Honor, I didn't try this case, but I just could tell you my experience is contrary to that. Our judges up here have always admitted the chain of custody documentations, whether the analyst testifies or not. And I've tried a lot of drug cases over the years. Unfortunately, I'm not as lucky as you. We end up having to call our analysts most of the time to testify. This was kind of an unusual circumstance. But I've had multiple of my cases reviewed by this court over the year in which that very same exhibit has gone to the jury as part of proving up chain of custody. But I will acknowledge that this narrative portion contained in this controlled substance evidence submission form from the BCA is something relatively new. And this isn't part of the record, but I can just tell you that approximately 2 years ago, BCA changed its testing policies, especially with regard to drug paraphernalia, because there are so many cases, they've set some limits as to what they will or will not analyze. And so they're requiring officers to set forth this narrative in their document. I've never had the circumstance where that portion of the document actually got submitted into evidence, but I will tell you, at least in my experience, Judge Kirk, that those chain of custody documents are always offered and accepted into court as part of the report of the examination of physical evidence.
I have a question to follow up on that. I think your argument is basically this is not prosecutorial misconduct because it doesn't fall on the prosecutor. It's not plain error because the district court isn't required to sua sponte prohibit the introduction of an exhibit such as that. But what about ineffective assistance of counsel? Didn't her counsel, trial counsel, fail to exercise reasonable due diligence by not allowing that portion of the exhibit in the form that had that narrative?
Well, Your Honor, can I just clarify one point? My argument is that the prosecutor did not engage in misconduct in this case. I do concede he committed an error in submitting this exhibit in this format without redacting that statement out of it. I don't want to be seen as condoning the conduct entirely. I just think there's a distinction between an error that occurs and misconduct, especially the way counsel has framed this as an intent to mislead or deceive either the jury, the judge, or defense counsel. That's not in the record here.
Okay, now, before you answer my question, I actually have another one that you raised there. And if you can help me clarify, are you arguing that under the plain error standard, it should be the traditional plain error standard or the modified one based on an allegation of prosecutorial misconduct because the error of allowing in a document that should not have been admitted?
My argument is the traditional standard applies, Your Honor, because this is an error. This is an ordinary trial error. That's exactly what it was in Mosley, Pearson, Hall, that whole line of cases. The same type of error occurred in none of those cases. Did either the Supreme Court or this court label that to be misconduct? Just because counsel calls it misconduct doesn't make it so. And that's one of the problems that I have, is that this term misconduct gets thrown around so frequently. Just calling it that doesn't make it so. I believe this should be reviewed under the standard plain error doctrine. With regard to your ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Your Honor, I just will tell you, I'm always troubled when an attorney is accused of ineffective assistance of counsel and is never given a chance to defend their actions. Granted, in this state, you have a right to raise the issue on a direct appeal if you want to. Frankly, I believe that these should be raised in post-conviction most cases, because I would have liked to heard what Mr. Goodmanson's argument was. I've tried cases against him for more than 20 years. He's a very experienced attorney. What you have here, I believe, and again, this is my opinion, is you have an error that occurred, that it just was something that got overlooked. But again, it's appellant's burden under an ineffective assistance counsel. And this is an affirmative burden. Mr. Goodmanson is presumed to have provided adequate assistance, and it's counsel's burden under the second prong, even if he meets the first prong, to prove that under the totality of the circumstances that there was an actual adverse effect on the proceeding. This, that is the verdict in this case. And all counsel has offered to you is speculation, and the Minnesota Supreme Court and Gates and other cases has made clear that speculation is not sufficient. I see that I'm out of time here, and I would thank you for your time, unless the court has got some other additional question you want to ask me.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Scanlon, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. You are muted, sir.
I did find that where in the appellant's brief it refers to the amount of time it took to put in the testimony and then the amount of time that they deliberated. The first is on page 10 of appellant's brief, and that's the pagination in the brief itself. Footnote. It's mentioned in the first full paragraph, but also in footnote 2. And then the time that they were out was, I think, 48 minutes, and that's on page 11.
Thank you, counsel.
Our position is that this is the prosecutor's error. It's their exhibit. They assembled this exhibit. They submitted this exhibit. Of course, they didn't refer to every word of it. They, as far as they were concerned, the middle two pages were chain of custody. They weren't chain of custody, by the way, as I argued in my reply to their brief. It does not establish chain of custody. Nobody knows how the pipe got from Faustin to the BCA. The deputy testified to that fact. So it doesn't even establish chain of custody. And Judge Kirk is right. Of course, the defense attorney doesn't look at it. We stipulated to the result, and he puts in the exhibit, and we assume that that's what it is. It's almost as if the state's position is that if nobody in trial notices an error, this court can't do anything about it. Of course you can. And I do believe this was prosecutorial misconduct. And I state in my reply brief, the ABA standard, the prosecutor should diligently seek to identify all information in the possession of the prosecution or its agent. It needs to review what it's putting in as an exhibit. That's an ABA standard. And of course, violation of an ABA standard can be considered misconduct. In any event, it's their error more than anyone else's. Obviously, from my position, it is, of course, also ineffective assistance. And we only mention the judge not noticing, not because we think the judge should read all exhibits, but because, again, it goes to that idea of fairness and integrity. It's a shame that nobody saw this. I mean, that's very troubling. That nobody noticed something this prejudicial went to the jury. And of course, there's not a case out there that has this exact fact situation, because it doesn't happen. I mean, exhibits with purported confession that isn't true don't go to the jury. And as far as whether anybody in there read it or not, we absolutely presume that jurors follow instructions. And they were instructed to review all of the evidence. We absolutely use that presumption in cases in deciding whether there was prejudice or not, whether we're reversing or not. We use it against appellants all the time. And this time, it actually is in our favor. We presume that they read what they are given. They're told to review all of the evidence in the case. They had four photographs. And they had this one 4-page document. Page one says it's meth. Page four says we got this thing. We're supposed to test it for meth. And page two and three has all this other nitty gritty, fascinating stuff. FBI number. Oh, my gosh. I mean, of course, jurors look at this stuff different than lawyers do. We see this stuff all the time. I mean, of course, if you're a lawyer, you might just kind of glance over, oh, it's chain of custody stuff. It's just a bunch of. No, jurors are going to pore over that. They're going to say, oh, this is interesting. I've never seen this before. Oh, let's read this.
Mr. Scanlon?
We have to read it.
Mr. Scanlon?
Yes.
Can you cite to any case law, precedential case law, that states that in situations like this, where the admission of evidence that should not have been admitted is prosecutorial misconduct, such that it requires the modified plain error standard to apply rather than the traditional plain error standard to apply?
I do think it's a modified plain error standard, and there are any number of cases. Strawman is one, is kind of a well-known case where they're applying the modified, they're putting the burden on the state to demonstrate the lack of prejudice. And there, any of the cases, even Mosley, the ones that Mr. Bueller is citing are ones that with prosecutor misconduct on the admission of evidence, admitting something that was inadmissible, treating that as prosecutor misconduct and applying the modified plain error review. Strawman wasn't just about inadmissible evidence. There also were issues with the instructions as well, but certainly the admission of evidence in that case was reviewed. They applied the modified plain error.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? Appreciate your briefing and your arguments today, counsel. Very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion in the statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you.